Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, where I live in central Pennsylvania, everywhere you go, you can't drive on any road without seeing a May 18th vote yes for livelihoods and lives. Or lives and livelihoods or whatever it is. And I've had a bunch of people go, what exactly is that? Because who could possibly be against lives and livelihoods? Who could possibly be against that? Until you dig in to find out what it is, because evidently May 18th, there are going to be four questions on the ballot to add things to our Constitution. Two of them are going to limit our government's ability to deal with emergency crisis. One is going to add some anti-discrimination language, and one is to give, and I don't know how this got on there, but this is to allow paid fire departments to run deficits like the volunteers. Not quite sure why that's there, but that's the direction we're going. And here to share some thoughts on the four ballot questions, I've asked J.J. Abbott to come talk with us. He's Executive Director of Commonwealth Communications. You can check out their website, vote.pa. J.J., thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me, Rick. I'm excited to talk about these with you.
So I'm looking at these. I'm seeing these signs everywhere. I don't know if they're where you are, but I am seeing them everywhere. There's big money behind this because it's my view, and you can tell me if I'm wrong, this is part of a much bigger strategy, a nationwide strategy, just not here in my little sleepy hamlet that we're getting inundated with this stuff. But this is part of a national plan.
Definitely. And, there's 45 states that have seen proposals in various forms to limit the authority of governors in emergencies. A lot of this is steeped heavily in the sort of science denial and COVID truther movement that we saw that really took over big portions of the Republican Party, particularly in 2020. And so what we really have here is a legislature in Pennsylvania. We have a very Republican and conservative legislature, which felt like everything that the government was doing during this emergency should have been subject to their approval or not. Unfortunately, their own track record doesn't speak too well to that. They didn't wear masks. They had mass COVID outbreaks, and they did pretty much nothing last year except try to roll back mitigation efforts that were put in place to protect workers, protect the most vulnerable. And so now we're seeing that these constitutional amendments that were put on the ballot for the May primary, which is, the primary after a presidential election is usually the lowest turnout election in the state. And so these are really an effort to try to undermine the governor's authority in a disaster. But I think what's important is it goes much further than just COVID-19. I mean, right now, Pennsylvania, we have about 60% of people over 16 that have already gotten their first shot of the vaccine. They talk about lockdowns, but if anyone in Pennsylvania drives anywhere, you see everything is bustling again. People are out and about, going about, pretty much their lives as normal. And so really what this is about is trying to undermine the governor, and really the effects of it are much more in the future when we have a disaster situation like a flood that we see here a lot in the summers in Pennsylvania, a hurricane, a really bad snowstorm. Now, because the legislature wants retribution for how the governor handled COVID, we're in a situation where we may have to have 253 legislators weighing in on a disaster emergency and whether the government should keep responding to it or not. So, in addition to it not really being great policy, it really doesn't make a lot of sense when you look at how the state should be responding to emergencies.
Well, but this is the Republican MO. These are people who tell you government should do nothing. We want government in charge of nothing. It should all be the private sector, the profit sector that does this. So it's not surprising to me that they want to hobble government. They want to make it as ineffective as possible so that they can turn around and when something bad happens, you go, see, look, government doesn't work.
I think there's that. And then I think there's also trying to leverage emergencies. And we saw this with the election, right? We saw last year in Pennsylvania, Republicans tried to leverage a very simple reform around pre-canvassing in order to get their agenda to ban drop boxes and limit mail-in voting. And so what we know is that, these partisan actors have a track record of sort of when they have leverage, they will try to use it for their agenda. And so an emergency is the last time where you want a partisan situation, but even more so, it's sort of a clarion call here. We know what they will do with leverage like this. And I think that's a real concern about these amendments. But you're right, it's part of a larger strategy that we've been seeing for decades, trying to undermine our democratic institutions, trying to undermine the role of government in protecting and improving our communities and taking care of people. And so this is all part of this larger strategy, to undermine government. And it's also part of a larger strategy, for the last 6+ years, Pennsylvania has been protected from this legislature because of the governor. His veto pen has protected us from having right to work and other attacks on workers. It's protected us from attacks on abortion rights and women's rights. It's protected us from attacks on voting rights. And so we know that they are looking for a strategy of how they can get around the executive branch and the veto pen. And if they can succeed with something like this, who knows what's next? We've already seen proposals from a potential candidate for governor on the Republican side, where he wants to try to roll back mail-in voting in as early as the 2023 primary.
And you're talking about the super spreader, the super spreader kid, Mastriano.
Yes. So, and I don't think that's the end. There was a proposal that the Republicans pushed last year and tried but failed to push again this year to try to gerrymander the judiciary, to take away democratically elected judges out of our system. And whether you believe in electing judges or not, the system that they want to do would basically give them complete control over the judiciary and allow them to elect a bunch of right-wing judges to enact their agenda. So we know they're trying to use these constitutional amendments, not just in Pennsylvania, but across the country, and ballot referendums to undermine government and to really, put government in a more difficult position to protect and take care of people, which is really the number one thing that government should be doing.
No, I'm right there with you. Now, you said a second ago that this primary is usually the lowest turnout, the primary after a presidential election, the lowest turnout. I see these two pieces, these two ballot questions, one stripping the governor of the ability to respond and the length of time that they get to respond as something to gin up people going to the polls. This is to rile the base, to get them all tingling in the panties so that they do come out and vote on May 18th. Have you seen any polling on this? Because I fear, because there haven't, there I, to my knowledge, there hasn't been a ballot question like this that's gone down in defeat. Do you see that there's no opposition to it that I've seen? Do you see this just passing? How do you see these things happening?
Well, I think there's a couple of things in that. There hasn't been any polling, but one of the things that's a little bit encouraging is that there's been about 750,000 people who've requested mail-in ballots already for this primary, and about 75% of those are Democrats. We do have more. We have really important elections at the local level, particularly in Democratic primaries. There's really important, really competitive primaries in Pittsburgh and Philadelphia and Allentown and some of the other larger urban areas in Pennsylvania. And I think the other thing that it's important is that the questions are also a referendum on the legislature. And so, potentially there, if we have a little bit higher Democratic turnout than usual, there may be some people there may be some people that don't really agree with our legislature or have a high opinion of them. And the last thing I think is important is what we talked about a little bit before, which is that, the messaging here is just really not in touch with reality. They're saying vote yes, end the lockdowns. They're really trying to play this up as if there's some sort of totalitarian control, that there's they keep calling Tom Wolf a dictator, which is, if anyone's an observer of Pennsylvania, sort of hilarious because they used to call him the professor and now he's this big bad dictator. And so I just don't think that's really in touch with reality. I mean, Pennsylvania is almost now leading the country in terms of vaccine distribution. Things are pretty much opened up. And so I just don't know that it's totally in touch with where people are right now. Maybe a few months ago, people were more frustrated than they had been previously about the pandemic and the restrictions. But, you know, for the most part now, towns in Pennsylvania are back to normal. And so and people are getting the vaccine and they're starting to reunite with their families because of the work that's particularly that's been done at the federal and state levels to really ramp up distribution. So, you know, I get a lot of flack for being an optimist. You know, I hope that people will read these questions, really think about whether they want to put the legislature between themselves, you know, their community and an emergency, and hopefully pause before they hit that yes button. But you are correct. I think we've had 17 referendums in Pennsylvania history and all 17 have been approved. But these are probably the more controversial of those that we've had.
Now, question one, if you vote yes for question one, what the League of Women Voters is saying that you agree to give the legislature by a simple majority of 51 votes the sole power to take the governor's existing authority away in making decisions during an emergency and coordinating with relevant Pennsylvania agencies. So all it's going to take is 50% plus one to get to basically strip the governor of his power during a crisis. If you vote yes, that's what you are voting for on question one. The ballot question number two, it's you agree that the change of existing law to limit the governor's disaster emergency, no matter the severity, to 21 days from the 90 days that it is now, unless and until the legislature votes by a simple majority to extend that and take away the governor's authority to manage new emergency and disaster situations. So what you're doing by voting yes is taking the ability of the governor to respond to these crises away in times where seconds mean lives.
That's right. And I think it's bigger than that, too, because, you know, these disaster declarations, like the way that they've been portrayed is completely nonsense. Like these are really technical documents. And I should just say, I was Governor Wolf's press secretary for 3 years. And for the 5 years that I worked in the governor's office, I was directly involved in the emergency response, working with agencies like the Pennsylvania Emergency Management Agency, the Pennsylvania State Police. What these disaster declarations do, they really don't give the governor all that much. What they give is local communities, first responders, emergency managers, they give them the power and the resources that they need to respond. They allow the state to get federal funding. They allow the government to do emergency procurement. They allow them to suspend regulations so that they can respond as needed without having to worry about, things like whether, you know, like certifications and things like that, so that they, you know, something in the pandemic, for instance, you know, they were allowed retired healthcare workers to come back and administer things like tests and vaccines. And so these are really run of the mill, core government operations. They're not even where you get the authority to do things like limit business activity or have occupational limits. Those are all derived from a public health law that's completely separate from this. So this is really a kind of a red herring for this, like, COVID truther, that they've really portrayed throughout the last year or so. And really what we're talking about doing is just disrupting the government at the time where you want it to be most effective, which is when an emergency or disaster strikes in your community and you want every resource to be there as quickly as possible.
Yeah, I want the governor, no matter who it is, to be able to respond to a crisis. I don't want to handcuff someone in those moments where seconds mean lives. So me personally, on questions one and two, I'll be voting no. That's my view, and I don't know where you're going to go, but I'm voting no on those two.
I'm definitely voting no, and I just wanted to plug real quick. We have a guide set up to give people some more background on these questions. You can go to vote.pa/guide. Again, vote.pa/guide. And that's our progressive voters guide. You can learn more about all four of the questions on the ballot and read why we are recommending no, yes.
So the last two, question number three is adding anti-discrimination language to the Constitution based on an individual's race or ethnicity. This is the one that I think is going to go down because I just I see us as a as kind of a racist state to a degree, but you differ.
I think it will get approved. I think that's one of the reasons why we're going to see people be motivated to vote in this primary, and you know, particularly in some of our more diverse communities. This amendment was actually sponsored by Senator Vincent Hughes, the highest ranking black senator in Pennsylvania. And, you know, I really hope it passes. But, you know, I get your cynicism about it, not undue. But I'm really hopeful that we can defeat the first two and still have passage on the third.
So you can argue that the right has their thing to get everybody motivated to get out the vote. Let's stranglehold the governor. And the left, the Democrats have put this out to get their folks out. Because there are some, and I've had people reach out to me and say, but we already have, you know, anti-discrimination language in our Constitution. Why do we need to be redundant? Why don't we just enforce what we have?
Well, so there's a federal protection. This basically mirrors it in the state constitution. There's about half the states have done the same. The one thing, I just wanted to say, too, about this election is I think that we're going to see whether there's still faith in our institutions. You know, I think coming out of January 6th, you know, there's a lot of Republicans who actually turned against their own party and saw that, you know, people didn't do enough to try to overturn the Democratic election here. But I think there's also a lot of enthusiasm among progressive and liberal people who want to stand up and participate as almost a form of protest against what we saw on January 6th. So I'm optimistic that we'll have higher turnout than we've seen before.
And finally, real quick, we got about 30 seconds. Ballot question number four. I don't know why we need a constitutional amendment to allow fire departments to run a little bit of debt. Real quick, if you can explain
it's about, that. A referendum. It's sort of a weird legal thing, but this actually is great for our local governments. It will allow more flexibility for fire and EMS in places like Philadelphia and Pittsburgh. Definitely urge people to vote yes on that one.
All right, real simple. The website vote.pa /guide. We'll get links out on social media how you can check that out. JJ, it was great talking with you, man. I hope you'll come back and share some more thoughts as we move towards the big election season there in 2022.
You got it. Anytime.
Good stuff. Appreciate the time. JJ Abbott, Executive Director there of Commonwealth Communications. Let's take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. Listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Saving work in America. One show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1911. That was the day the state of Wisconsin passed the Wisconsin Workmen's Compensation Act. The state became the first to have a constitutional system for providing medical expenses, wage loss payments, or death benefits to employees or their families. The law is regarded as a pioneering act of social legislation and a major accomplishment of Wisconsin's progressive movement. Activist journalism exposed deadly and disfiguring working conditions in the country's industries. State industrial commissions were established to conduct factory inspections and demand reform legislation and regulations. Upton Sinclair's initial intent in writing The Jungle was to cultivate a public outcry for better and safer working conditions. By 1907, the Russell Sage Foundation funded dozens of investigators to study industrial and social conditions in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Two volumes of essays were produced, entitled The Pittsburgh District, Civil Frontage, and Wage Earning Pittsburgh. The essay Work Accidents and the Law, written by Crystal Eastman, exposed the enormity of work-related accidents and deaths and the failure of employers to compensate victims and their families. Her investigation examined several industries, including railroads, steel, and coal mining. She noted, quote, "There is no bright side to this situation. By industrial accidents, Allegheny County loses more than 500 workmen every year, of whom nearly half are American-born. 70% are workmen of skill and training, and 60% have not yet reached the prime of their working life. Youth, skill, strength, in a word, human power is what we are losing. Eastman's survey worked to shift the burden from workers to employers. It is largely credited with the passage of workers' compensation laws, though it would take decades for similar laws to be enacted in states throughout the nation.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So the big winner of the Kentucky Derby over the weekend, Medina Spirit, I guess, Medina Spirit, that is the winner. But for me, I wasn't watching the race. As we talked about on Friday, I was watching to see what the valets, not valets, what the valets were doing there at the Kentucky Derby, if they were going to go on strike or not. 13 workers were saying, look, we only make $109 a day. This is a $1 billion industry. The weight of the world is on our shoulders to ensure that these horses are properly presented on race day. One screw up by us and you're disqualified. Making $109 a day over the next 3 years, they want to make $130 a day. We're not talking about breaking the bank. You're talking about $21 a day over the next 3 years in increases. There's a problem here, Houston. And the problem is that we've got these $1 billion industries that are going, no, sorry, not enough. There's not enough left over after we're done lining our pockets and filling our trough. Sorry, you working stiffs. Nothing for you. Now, the threat of the strike was there, is what I was watching for. And I got to tell you, my wife is a horse person. Horse people are crazy. And they sacrifice for the horse. They sacrifice for that. That's their thing. And I was not surprised that the valets did not go on strike. They have promised to work together. They've said we're going to work with the Kentucky Derby people to try and get their increases. But they didn't want to hold the race hostage. It's what they do. They don't do it because it's a great living. They do it because they love it. And you'd have to be in the muck and the mud and dealing with all of the stuff that you deal with horses, which I want no part of. And the reason I say that, look, I love my wife dearly. Gonna hopefully be with me until I am no longer here. But she used to go up on her free time and work for free, shoveling horse stuff out of stalls for free. This is what crazy people do. Not horses. I'm sorry, they were mules. Never mind. Same four-legged creature, just different ears. But they didn't go on strike, and hopefully that they will get the contract. There are other races coming up where this potentially could happen down the road. But I did learn something through this. I did learn that I did not know that they put weights in the saddles to make the horses all somewhat even. That was kind of a Harrison Bergeron-ish, if you will. Just kind of a weird thing. But I didn't know that if they didn't meet weight, they disqualified them. And you're paying someone $109 a day to make sure your $1 million horse is weighted properly so that you could win the multi-$1 million prize. Does that not seem nuts to you? Wouldn't you want the people who have been doing it, years to be well compensated so that they stay? Or are you planning on the insanity of what these horse people do? Or in my wife's case, mule people. Sorry. Crazy, crazy stuff. But we'll see. We're going to keep track of that. But this is just another one of those examples where these big corporations have all of this power and all of these resources to deny workers, a minimal increase. Because the laws aren't on their side. Because trust me, if they had gone on strike, they would have brought in scabs to replace them. And I personally think it would have been in the best interest. But this is just me. I had one of those scabs boogered it up and you end up having someone's horse being disqualified. That would have been really unfortunate for them. But, Yeah. So we'll see how this works for them down the road. But 147th Kentucky Derby. There you go. I'd love to hear your thoughts. You can email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. I'm going to take a quick break. When we come back, Bob Ney, our good friend from Ohio, going to share some thoughts on the top stories of the day, of which some really important stuff. India, Iran. We're not going to hit herd immunity. Evidently, that's not going to happen because we have too many, well, morons. I don't know where else to go with that. Just a bunch of morons. I'd love to hear your thoughts. You can email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. Quick break. Right back after this. Stick around.
Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
The gap between what we are doing and what actually needs to be done is widening by the second.
New climate targets still not enough to close the emissions gap. Republicans' infrastructure proposal about one-fifth the size of Biden's. Plus,
say goodbye to your burgers. In order to help hit the Biden administration's climate goals, a limit of 4 pounds of red meat per year or a single average-sized burger every month.
Fox News forced to admit Biden's climate plans do not ban red meat.
All of those stories and more straight ahead from BradBlog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
A graphic and a script incorrectly implied that it was part of Biden's plan for dealing with climate change. That is not the case.
The Green News Report would like to apologize. We refer to Fox News as news. That is not the case. This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, so Fox News spent all weekend long freaking out about Joe Biden canceling meat.
With maximal outrage.
And it turns out it's not true at all.
Nope.
Who could have guessed it?
But we'll have more on that in a moment. So, jobs and clean energy were the central focus of President Joe Biden's two-day virtual climate summit last week, attended by some 40 world leaders, business executives, labor union heads. Biden pledged to cut U.S. emissions 50% by 2030 under the Paris Climate Agreement and reach net zero emissions by 2050, calling climate action an unprecedented opportunity to create millions of jobs transitioning to clean energy.
And canceling meat.
No. Scientists say it's achievable with existing technology, but it'll be a very heavy lift. A new report by Europe's Climate Action Tracker calculates that even with the new, more ambitious pledges announced by the United States and other countries, it is still not enough to meet the Paris targets. And the world is way off track to achieve net zero carbon emissions by 2050 to avoid the worst impacts of climate change, unless countries pick up the pace of emissions cuts.
Uh-oh. Or if they cancel meat.
A different study from the European Commission's Joint Research Center finds that there's also a huge discrepancy between what the world's nations say they emit in greenhouse gases each year versus the amount of emissions that independent organizations have calculated using independent models. The gap is roughly equal to the annual emissions of the United States.
Uh-oh.
The researchers warn that the accounting discrepancy will complicate the already difficult task of pinpointing just how much and how fast nations must cut greenhouse gas pollution. Here in the U.S., congressional Republicans unveiled their own infrastructure counterproposal to Biden's American Jobs Plan. Biden proposes to spend $2.2 trillion over 10 years repairing the nation's infrastructure, upgrading for climate impacts, and shifting to cleaner, safer, renewable energy. Republicans' infrastructure proposal is about one-fifth of that, a little over $560 billion.
And I'm guessing there's nothing in it at all about the climate.
Nope.
They protect burgers, I hope.
Right-wing media began lying about Biden's climate proposals right off the bat, and it demonstrates the right-wing propaganda cycle. They highlighted a year-old, totally unrelated study that suggests that one way to help reduce emissions would be reducing consumption of red meat. The UK's Daily Mail then baselessly speculated that Biden would ban red meat, and then Fox News and right-wing media ran with that lie so Republicans could denounce the imaginary policy. Fox News did not retract that story. story for 3 days.
Well, you have to have something to be angry about if you're Fox News or Republican.
Meanwhile, the Biden administration is moving quickly. The Environmental Protection Agency and the Transportation Department have both rescinded a Trump-era attempt to strip the state of California of its special authority to set its own vehicle tailpipe emissions and pollution standards. Both agencies announced Monday they will restore California's right to set climate limits on cars and SUVs, which many car makers, like General Motors, have already announced that they're going to shift to all electric vehicles by 2035.
Oh, how nice of them. Instead of Republicans trying to use big government to leverage against small states, the Biden administration is actually letting states do what they please when it comes to limiting carbon emissions.
Finally, Swedish teen climate activist Greta Thunberg testified to the House Oversight Committee on Earth Day. With her characteristic bluntness, Thunberg correctly criticized the pledges made by countries so far as insufficient and delivered a stark warning to those who would delay action.
You still have time to do the right thing and to save your legacies. But that window of time is not going to last for long. We, the young people, are the ones who are going to write about you in the history books. We are the ones who get to decide how you will be remembered. So my advice for you is to choose wisely.
Oh, man. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, please check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Find, follow, and share us planet-wide on the Facebooks and the Twitters at Green News Report. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Choose wisely. This has been your Green News Report.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So the big news of the day, Bill and Melinda Gates are getting a divorce. You know who cares less than me? Nobody. I don't know why this is a story. I don't know why anybody pays attention to it. And I actually don't know why I brought it up. Because, to be honest, nobody cares less than I do. Anyway, we're here to share some thoughts on the top stories of the day. Maybe he cares if Bill and Melinda Gates are getting divorced. It'll be interesting to see what she does with her money, if she does what Mackenzie Scott did with the Bezos money and just gave it all away. Anyway, our good friend, former Ohio congressman and political analyst, Bob Ney. Bob, thanks for taking time for us.
Appreciate it, Rick.
What do you think? You care?
No, but I am curious to see who gets the biggest divorce settlement, because I think that Bezos was the biggest settlement in history, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So, see if the 1% can outdo the other 1%.
Yeah, I don't think so. I think Bezos is still going to be the highest, because I think he was worth more than Gates is.
I know, but Gates might be a little more generous, you know. You never know.
Yeah. Or, could just turn pure evil. Anyway, let's get to something really important. I don't care about the divorces of the rich and famous unless they're giving me a portion of the proceeds.
There you go.
And if Melinda Gates wants to give free money away, I'll give her my address. Big news, evidently we're still on the bipartisan infrastructure plan. The White House and Chief of Staff Ron Klain has reaching out to Shelley Moore Capito to do some more negotiations.
Yes. Now, they've actually been... Shelley Moore Capito, of course, will be key, and she's from West Virginia, which is interesting because Senator Manchin is from West Virginia, the Democratic member, who everybody seems to watch these days. So it'll be interesting to see what Shelley Moore Capito does. But the White House has been sending the Chief of Staff and a couple of other top staffers over to the Capitol and have been meeting with the Republicans, including Senator Wicker of Mississippi also. So we'll see what happens.
So if you're the Democrats, if you're Schumer and you're Biden, if this is what the Republicans are offering to go through the normal channels, you're going to get 10 Republican votes for, $568 billion. Do you take it?
Well, if they're going to, provide the votes, you're going to take it. But I think that when it comes to Senator Schumer, he's not going to get involved in a negotiation at this point in time with with Republican senators when the White House is talking to them. It wouldn't probably benefit him to get into the negotiation. He'll wait and see what happens.
Yeah.
And then, of course, if they don't get anybody, then it'll be up to Schumer to get everybody to toe the line for the 50 votes.
So you're someone who pays attention to this. I guess basic math, $2.3 trillion and $568 billion are kind of different worlds. But as you've pointed out in the past, there are four different kind of bills with this, right?
Well, yes. The bill is divided into four parts, and you know, you and I have talked about that. Now, I'm thinking this through my mind. Do they increase the basic infrastructure and they try to go with that and get bipartisan votes and then take the other three parts and separate them and vote it on their own in that case, it would only be Democratic members.
Right.
I mean, that is one way to do it. I doubt that they will be able to keep the other three parts in there and get Shillingworth Capito. So that might be one way to do it. And then still, get the straight party line vote to get the other three parts of the bill.
Now, the reason I ask that is because,
bifurcate that.
Right, because the reason I ask that, let's say you do one part of the bill, which is the roads, bridges, and what were considered physical, 1950s type infrastructure. How much is the $568 billion compared to what is in the Biden plan, the larger, $2.3 billion plan, which, as you pointed out, is put into four parts? How does it compare with when you compare the apples and apples?
Well, they would have to come up in the amount of money the Republicans would, because the president is not going to want to go below what he had in, quote, basic infrastructure, which was above $600 billion. He's not going to want to go below that. If he's going to go below that, then he might as well just take the entire bill as it is with all four parts and try to get the 50 votes. So really it kind of depends on what the couple of the Democratic senators will do. Will they, let the White House try to negotiate, or will they come along and just try to do the entire bill itself?
Now, if you do get this, let's say the Democrats and Republicans do move the $568 billion or maybe $600 billion,
right.
Can they then take the other parts that he has in the $2.3 trillion plan minus the $600 billion and take that through budget reconciliation?
They could if they wanted to. They could. They have three shots, basically, at that to deem three different times, as I understand it, maybe four, a budget reconciliation language. So, yes, they could do that.
Yeah, I keep asking the question because you brought up one time, the budget's 13 different bills. I don't know why you can't do 13 different budget reconciliation bills.
If they would go back to what they used to do, where they would have 13, the Senate was always a little bit different, but the House would have 13 separate votes, then the Senate would begin the path of 13 separate votes, and sometimes they combine all of those 13 votes into one and put it into the package, and sometimes they would vote separately. So
yeah.
I'm thinking in my mind, if you did 13 measures, why could you not have included material, that they want to pass, language, into 13 different budget votes, which are reconciliation votes? I don't know. I don't know if they're going to try something like that or not. It gives them more options if they did.
I'm waiting to see what the big secret plan is. If mm-hmm. they're not going to do away with the filibuster, let's see how that works. Let's move along. I know you're someone who likes to travel to India. I know you're very fond of the country. I've spent lots of time there. They're in a real mess right now. In fact, we've blocked travel to and from India. I wanted to get your thoughts.
Yes, we have. Modi is the prime minister, and he just lost an election in a pretty key state to him of West Bengal on Sunday. Yesterday, he lost that election. His party did. And then he lost also in Kerala, which is basically on the ocean. He lost in that section of India. They have, states that vote for their parties, sort of like Israel, in a sense. You've got to put a coalition together, and does your party win? India is in big trouble. Modi is being criticized as he has never been criticized before, the prime minister. But putting aside what happens with him, you know, retaining prime minister, the country itself, Rick, is just in devastation, and it's going to need help like any country. Africa, too, you'll see headlines about it pretty soon, but India is just in a major problem. We're sending supplies, materials. They're out of oxygen, and I think other countries probably, you know, through the UN are going to do the same thing. And like anything, if we don't do something in India or Africa, then the variants of this whole epidemic are going to get stronger, and then it'll come back to get us.
No, and you know, the story today obviously was we're probably never going to reach herd immunity, and they say a couple of reasons. One being the variants are now, you know, getting out of control, but two, that they're, and I love, again, I love the nice soft language that we use in this country. There are some people who just have vaccine hesitancy, Bob. They're hesitant about the vaccine. It's not that they're complete morons, and you know, are just plain stupid. No, they're hesitant. They're hesitant.
Well, I know people. In fact, I had a discussion yesterday with some people that I know because they're on blood thinners and they don't want to take the vaccine. I'm on blood thinners. I had a heart attack. I'm on several medications. I took the vaccine. And I said to them, tell me where you're seeing stories of people who are on blood thinners that have died, you know, from this. So people are creating their own idea of why they don't do it or self-analyzing, you know, about this. And then a couple of people told me, well, we're going to wait and see. Wait and see what? How long are you going to wait and see?
Yeah.
I mean, I know it's a free choice, but to me, if you have a situation where you're on blood thinners, where you have a bad heart, why would you not take the vaccine? Because if you get COVID, believe me, you are going to obviously decrease your chances to live.
Yeah, you're done. But, you know, it got me thinking, you know, as I said at the beginning, I used to push back on the frame that my grandparents' generation were the greatest generation. I used to push back on it by saying, look, every generation rises to the challenges that are in front of them. What choice do they have? Just that generation was saddled with a bunch of challenges, and yes, they got through them because that's what we do. I used to believe that, you know, every generation would, but I'll tell you, this challenge of this generation, of this moment, we're failing.
Yes, it's not working as it should. Some of the people of the generation are not providing, you know, I think the leadership that they should for others to see that, you know, this is the right thing to do and we've got to stand up for the causes. It's a very trying and disturbing time, I think.
Yeah, can you imagine, you know, when the polio vaccine came out, going, no, you know, we can right. We can do with some polio. We don't have to do away with all of it. We can have some.
Right, exactly.
Crazy.
Yeah.
Also, another place you spent a lot of time, I wanted to get some of your thoughts on, because the big conservative freakout this weekend was evidently there's a prisoner swap going on with Iran, a deal, I guess, with the U.S. and British prisoners that are being released for cash. We're buying our prisoners back, Bob.
Well, now, right now, Washington is denying that there are, you know, prisoner swaps in agreement. Of course, we've denied it before. They've denied it before. But Iran state television says that there's a prisoner swap deal in exchange for the release of $7 billion in frozen Iranian oil funds under the sanctions. And I'm not sure that there is for $7 billion, you know. I think the fact that the Biden administration is having talks in Vienna with Iran, period, is going to incite all kinds of stories. You're going to see everything under the sun because, you know, it's obviously a fact that Saudi Arabia, although it's starting to actually think about communicating with Iran, but Saudi Arabia does not want this to happen. Netanyahu does not want this to happen. And you're going to see, again, all kinds of stories about, you know, the United States, what we're doing. This is trying to bring back memories of the, quote, cash on pallets that, you know, President Obama had given to Iran as part of the nuclear deal to get their money back.
Yep.
So you're going to see everything under the sun. The bottom line is, when President Obama and VP Biden at the time did the Iran nuclear deal, the amount of centrifuges that were done to enrich, you know, the products to make a nuclear bomb, those were scaled back. And when the deal was cut by the Trump administration, they increased. That's the bottom line. There are those who will absolutely pull the panic button every single time we dare to talk with the Iranians.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the enriched uranium is a problem. And as you've said, you know, sure, during that period, it wasn't perfect, but it was the possible. And you know, that's part of my problem with a lot of folks. They're willing to give up the possible for the perfect. Or just in this case, and look, I believe there are some who never want any deal because they want the conflict. They want the problem. They want to be able to blame people. They need that to keep us pitted against one another. And no matter what we do with Iran, it's not going to be right or enough or whatever.
Well, and remember, the people that are complaining the most about this, for example, Mohammed bin Salman, the Saudis, let us remember that they throw people off of buildings. Let us remember they restrict human rights. And let us remember they had 19 people on an airplane years back, right?
And let us remember that they chopped up a reporter into pieces.
Reporter,
and took them out in bags.
Right, in Khashoggi. So, you know, but they come out every single time we want to talk about Iran and say how bad the regime is. Is the Iran regime a walk in the park? No. But can we interact with them as we did when President Obama was in office and create a deal? Yes. Once we cancel that deal, then everybody said, well, we've got to do something about the Iranians. What? Go to war? I mean, that's where it leads to. So you're going to hear all kinds of stories out there every single time we talk to them in Vienna.
Yeah. You know, but it's one of those things. I'm looking at Iran, and I don't hear anything coming out about how COVID is affecting them. Is there anything going on there that we know of?
It's gotten better. Iran, of course, had a problem when it, you know, when it began. It was in severe trouble, but I think that they've done better, you know, with trying to get it under control.
Yeah, because, you know, I'm looking at these places around the world. I'm going, you know, at some point, if we don't deal with this, and I know the administration is giving out, getting stuff out to the rest of the world, some excess vaccines and stuff. But it just seems like, you know, it's never going to go away. And look, I look at the statement today where they're saying that, you know, maybe the best we can hope for on the COVID-19 front is that it's no longer a societal disruptor, that it's just, you know, a regular infectious disease that we continue to get from now until eternity.
Mm-hmm. Well, yes, and they don't know about the variants yet, but they do know, you know, the countries have to come up to speed. We can't sit and say, well, Africa can be up to speed in 2.5 years, or India can be up to speed in 2.5 years. We can't do that. I mean, the world has to get involved with this. And then, of course, there's always the attack, which I'm surprised that President Biden hasn't been attacked of, quote, not taking care of Americans. He is, but I'm surprised he hasn't been attacked for that.
Yeah, I am as well.
By helping another country.
Yeah, but here's the thing. I mean, the vaccines are widely available. I don't hear any reports of shortages. I don't hear any reports of people going, hey, I couldn't get mine. In fact, what we're seeing is that drop off that we've gotten most of the people who wanted it. And it's just the people who they're hesitant, Bob. They're just hesitant.
Right. By us helping other parts of the world does nothing to hurt us, put it that way, here in the United States. Right now, the only problem we have is getting people who haven't gotten the shot that should get the shot, that have no problems, you know, medically right now to get the shot. Those people need to be convinced that it's for the good of the cause to get it. That's the problem we have.
Yeah. And finally, I wanted to get your thoughts on the big news today that the Biden administration is increasing the number of people seeking asylum from, I guess, 15,000 to 62,000.
Right. Well, they're doing, you know, he's raising a limit on the number of refugees allowed, you know, and I think the cap would be to what, 62,000, right?
I think 62,000 or 62,500.
Right. And so he's doing that. And then I think you're going to see other changes, too, because of the internal changes in the embassies. I mean, once COVID hopefully subsides and people start to, you know, come back, there's got to be internal changes that were done by the Trump administration through embassies to restrict people when they get interviewed to even come here, even with approved visas and student visas, because nobody's even touched the tip of that iceberg. So right now, you know, the president is going to, you know, do something with the to take it to 62,000.
Last question I've got for you. Back to the vaccine. Should Donald Trump be the president, or did he want it to be? The founder, the founder of the vaccine, or the father of the vaccine. That's what he wanted to be. He wanted to be the father of the vaccine.
Well, I think if Donald Trump had handled COVID even, you know, 50% more effectively than he did, he would be in the White House most likely today. You know, he didn't. So his era and legacy is going to be, you know, known. Did the vaccine come under his time? Yes, it you know, technically did. But the whole key is, how did he perform getting up to that time?
Yeah, Jonas Salk, he's not.
Right. How did he perform getting up to that time? Calling it a hoax, fighting certain things, you know, getting it himself, going to the hospital, making the parade trip around, waving. I mean, the whole thing, that's what's going to be remembered. Yep. Again, yes, we can't take it away from the administration that that they began a process, but the fact that, you know, it didn't unwrap like it should have and wasn't, you know, put out there around the country like it should have, that's not going to be erased. It didn't happen.
I think it's bizarre that he keeps, you know, interjecting himself at this moment. There, I know he, well, there's talk of he may run again. I know there's all kinds of stuff, but to, you know, to keep throwing that out there, I don't know.
Well, he's trying to create what he does and what he did best in 2016, and I don't think it's going to work. He's trying to create a brand. You know, he did this, he did that, and each time President Biden does something, then he's going to be the better deal guy, or the better vaccine guy, or he's going to have led this before the president did, and he's just throwing feeders out there. And the Republican Party is going to wait and see what he actually does. And even Mitch McConnell said if he runs, he's going to get the nomination. So that's what they're waiting to see.
Yeah, I think McConnell's right. I think the Republican Party is that far gone that I think he's absolutely right. But, Bob, I appreciate the time. As always, great stuff, my friend.
Thank you, Rick.
Good stuff, as always. And, look, you know, I go back to this, you know, the fact that we're in this moment where we have this vaccine. It is overwhelmingly safe. All of the indications are that it's overwhelmingly safe. I mean, they shut down getting the Johnson & Johnson vaccine for a couple of weeks because I guess it's up to 20 people, 20 women had gotten blood clots. And then they identified it, figured out how to treat it. Nobody that I know of has died from it. This is one of those things where you go, it is so safe that 20 people out of 7 million had something of a negative reaction, and they pulled it off the market. I'm in this position where I think the benefit of people being vaccinated outweighs the minor risks that are out there. And this comes back down to vaccinating or not vaccinating across the board. Will there be some people who have some reactions? Yeah, it's anything. Breathe too much air, drink too much water, whatever. There's a possibility always there. But for society as a whole, again, back to your rights infringing on everyone else's, I don't know. I go back to the vaccines are safe. I hope everyone will go out and make sure that they're protecting themselves and others. Now on that front, I will be doing my part on Thursday. I'm getting my second vaccination. I will then be fully vaccinated, and I'm looking forward to that. We here at the program are taking Thursday and Friday off, going to play the best of for those days. I'm anticipating, Everyone has told me, you know, you're going to get a reaction. You're not going to feel well for a couple of days. Plan for that. So I am planning for that. So we're throwing some stuff together, some of our better interviews over the last year, and get some content around that. But like I said, this is part of what I think we have to do as a country. We have to meet this challenge head on. This is our moment. And, you know, I go back to the greatest generation. In their moment, they rose to the challenge. They didn't blame everybody else. They didn't seek to divide each other and tear each other apart in public square. They rose to the challenge. They met it head on, and they actually won. This is one of those moments where I go, you know, the greatest generation can teach us some lessons. Sadly, there aren't many of them still around to remind us of what it took. But maybe, thinking about that era will help lead us forward. And look, as I said about Joe Biden, there are things that he's done in the past I'm not thrilled with. There are things that he wasn't my first choice. He's actually my fourth, maybe fifth. But I think he's the right guy for this moment. I think he is rising to the challenge, and I think he is leading us in the right direction. Again, you know, to me, it's that simple. I'd love to hear your thoughts, though. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. If you missed any of today's program, thericksmithshow.com, that's where you go to get the podcast. The Rick Smith Show app on the smartphone. Take the program on the go wherever you go. I appreciate you taking time for us. Thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Rick@thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's tough being rich. For one thing, you have to be on constant alert to keep commoners from encroaching on your turf and upsetting your sense of proper social order. Consider the angst of the swells who summer in the Hamptons, an ultra-tony seaside enclave of New York City's old wealth families and Wall Street elites on the eastern tip of Long Island. For generations, they've used local ordinances to keep us riffraff out of their exclusive communities. But now, they find themselves besieged by, believe it or not, Indians. The small reservation of some 1,600 members of the Shinnecock Indian Nation has also been there for generations. In fact, it's the rich white residents who are the invaders, for their Anglo predecessors first descended on Shinnecock lands in 1640. Today, the indigenous people struggle with poverty, gazing across a small bay at the huge summer mansions of their Gatsby-esque invaders. But now, to lift their own economy, the tribe intends to build a modest tribal-run casino on their reservation. Oh, the horror! Shrieked the Hamptonites. Yet, the reservation is the Shinnecock people's sovereign land, free from the Hampton elite's zoning laws. So the rich and mighty are reduced to begging the native people to just go away. A lot of us are bleeding-heart liberals and sympathetic to the oppressed, exclaimed one, but it's not the right location. It never is it? But casino revenue could help tribal families with such expenses as rent, food, utilities, and car payments. It could change the quality of life here overnight, says the tribal chief. But who cares? A few of the snobbiest of Hampton Blue Bloods haughtily warn they will move out if the Shinnecock Casino comes in. This is Jim Hightower saying, sounds like a good trade to me. The Hightower Radio Lowdown is brought to you by the Lowdown Happy Hour, live streamed from the Chat and Chew Cafe. Details at HightowerLowdown.org.